Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Tom Dinas, and this is the Delicious Legacy Podcast. Welcome to today's episode. I have a very special episode for you today, guys, which is all about cheese. I hope you cheese lovers out there, you will love it, and you will relish it, and share it with many, many others. The idea was to make an episode dedicated to ancient cheese. And this was the plan, and that's what I did, basically. But with me today, to talk about ancient cheese, I got the great honor to have Ned Palmer, a cheesemonger and author of a brilliant new book, A Cheesemonger's History of the British Isles, which is out now. And yeah, we will cover all ages of cheese. We'll talk about Neolithic Mesopotamia. We'll go to ancient Rome and the spread of cheese throughout Europe and Britain, all the while whilst eating ancient style cheeses and trying different textures and different ages, and trying ancient recipes with cheese, all of it of course for your pleasure and only, and purely for research purposes, honestly. So yeah, tune in and enjoy.
So we used to get, when I worked for Neil's Yard Dairy, we got the feta in the barrel, a full size,
nice.
Like that.
Yeah, proper.
And it was always like, it's your fucking turn to open the barrel. No, I did it! Because it's in the cold room, it's freezing.
Yeah.
And you smash open the barrel with a hammer and chisel. And then all it gets on your hands, and you discover how many tiny cuts you've got on your hands.
Oh no! It's
freezing brine. It's another world, that cheese though, isn't it?
Yeah.
So yeah, welcome to our podcast, The Delicious Legacy.
Thanks.
And yeah, today we have with us Ned Palmer, the author of The Cheesemonger's History of the British Isles. And we're going to talk about ancient cheese.
And we mean, you know, cheese of antiquity, not some really old bit of cheese. Like, we're not going to talk about, you know, a 50-year-old bit of cheddar that someone left down the back of a sofa.
No.
just setting the record
really,
straight.
Yeah, we'll try and find the origins of cheese, yeah, as much as we can. Yeah, so first I want to ask you a little bit about yourself. So how did you fall into the vat of curds?
It's like Obelix, isn't it? You know, falling into the magic potion. That is what I did. Fall into a magic potion, because my life since cheese has been magic.
And,
but the way that it started was literally that I ate a piece of cheese. It was Borough Market, it was winter 2000. I was back from Australia and learning that you can't make any money out of theatre. And my mate Todd said, come and sell my cheese at Borough Market. And he makes a traditional ceffyli, it's a Welsh style cheese. And he used to make it in his little village, Llandybie Brevi. Mm-hmm. In West Wales,
yeah.
And it's where he made it when I tried it. So I went down there. I'd never done anything like this before, retail, food, anything. And I tried some cheese and I felt angry because I realised that all the cheese I'd ever had in my life was rubbish.
Yeah.
And I was quite cross. And also I was obsessed because it was so fascinating. This flavour was so fascinating. It was so complex. How does this product, something simple made from milk, have that depth and complexity? He would bring the cheese down from the farm every week,
yeah,
and each batch would look different, and taste a bit different, but it's the same recipe, and it was like magic. And I was asking him lots of questions, and eventually he said, I'll get you a job at Neil's Yard Dairy if you stop bothering me. So I went there, and I was really lucky because they still stored all the soft cheese in the cellar in Covent Garden. And I worked with an amazing guy called Bill Oglethorpe, who's like the Yoda to my Luke Skywalker of cheese, you know? And he's super wise. He's a Zambian cheese maker now. So he makes cheese in a railway arch in Bermondsey. Swiss cheese in a railway arch in Bermondsey. He's a magic guy. So he taught me how to look after cheese.
Yeah.
Because we got them young and we grew the rinds, like we can see on the goat's cheese. We grew them on there and looked after them. And it was, you know, it's like a calling. And I didn't even know that was a thing.
Yeah.
And the first day that I went to the cellar, I looked at the rotor and it said cheese. And I'm a bit of a dick. So I went to the boss and said, you know, this is a cheese shop, right? And she went, go down to the cellar. And I went down and there's Bill and there's these things. And, you know, you have to turn them and pat them and rub them.
Yeah.
And you don't get a formal training. It's not like there's a book of, it's called affinage to do this because the British don't have we're not civilised enough to have a word for this yet. So the person who does it is called an affineur. You know, we have to borrow this French word. And there's no book. So Bill would teach you, but he's quite, what's the word, gnomic. He's like the Delphic Oracle.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't say much, and then he's quite elusive. He's very like a jazz musician in a way to me. So a lot of the time I learnt by touching the cheese, thinking this is quite wet. So I'll move it away from the humidifier to dry it a bit, or it's getting really soft, it's too hot, I'll cool it down. And we had no temperature control. Mm-hmm. So to make it hotter, you put it higher up in the attic. And to make it lower, you put it lower down. And just to make the connection to ancient cheesemaking, in Columella, I think it is, on Nature.
Yeah.
It's basically an agricultural treatise. He talks about affinage. And he says in the first stage, the cheeses must be put on a rack in the wind, you know, and separate enough from each other so that they don't huddle together and get too moist. And that's exactly what we did. And when I read it, it was like the hair stood up on my neck because there's a 2,000-year-old instruction for affinage, which I wish I'd, you know, someone had told me about.
Yeah.
But there's the guy doing exactly what I learned to do. So it's just, when you're doing it, it's magical. You know that you're connected with a past step.
Yeah,
The methods haven't changed.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
That's kind of one thing that was in my mind forever. Mm. You know, how much you can say that things are connected.
Yeah.
With all the cheese history.
Yeah.
And
well, should we try some cheese?
Of course. Yes.
So I'm going to just be rude and start with one of the ones I brought.
That's not rude at all.
Good.
Yeah.
And it's because it really... So this is a simple, fresh goat's cheese called Paroche.
Yeah.
And it's made in Herefordshire by all a guy called Charlie Westhead, who's a lovely man.
Mm-hmm.
And the tech... This for me... is the Ur cheese. It's the first cheese that appeared, the first evidence we find is in the Fertile Crescent in northern Turkey, what's now northern Turkey, in around 7,000 BC. And the only evidence is traces of milk fat on shards of pottery. That's all we've got. And some broken up bits of strainer. So they were draining curd.
Mm.
So I think with the simplest technology and just taking milk and letting it sour, which it would in the warm...
Yeah.
temperature with the culture that was living in the bowls and in the milk, even possibly some rennet if you made it in a very traditional way with a goat's stomach. I think you'd make this. Goats are the first dairying animals to be domesticated, I believe. So I think our first cheese was a goat's cheese, and I think it's a simple fresh cheese. And if the cheesemaker from 7,000 BC, you know, came over to Herefordshire and visited Charlie in his dairy, I think they would see what he was doing and recognise it. So even though now the equipment's made of stainless steel and plastic, it's the same stuff and the same process.
Yeah.
So I think there's an absolute continuity.
Oh, wow.
And it's beautiful, isn't it?
It's just beautiful, yeah. It's very fresh, obviously, as you said. But you can taste almost... the aromas of the grass and the flowers.
So true, yeah.
And the herbs and the cheese itself.
Yeah. That is a lovely... the sense of terroir that the flavour comes from the land, which again, a word we have to borrow from the French, great word. And the flavour of the grass and the herbs from that place may come through in the milk. This is such a simple fresh cheese that there's only the merest hint of that. I love the texture too.
Yeah.
And this is skillful cheese making. You know, you cannot, you have to be so gentle
right.
with the curd and so patient with the curd to have this beautiful soft texture. Mm. If you were stirring it really fast, you'd hurry, or heated it too fast, you would lose a lot of that
yeah.
beautiful texture. It's like a mousse.
It is. It's almost like a mousse, yeah.
I'm going to try it with a lovely wine. I actually often pair very fresh, acidic goat's cheese like this with a red. It's one of the few cheeses I do pair with a red.
Great.
Because I think they contrast each other and the cheese brings out the fruits.
I think a beer and white wine, I think it probably works a lot better generally with cheeses.
I do tend to think that. In fact, I know this is divisive, but I really think that beer is the most versatile partner for cheese and has so many flavours that are present in beer and present in cheese that you don't find in wine. Mm. Some of the caramelised, nutty
yes.
flavours you get from the malts, I guess,
yeah.
and some of the fruity, odd esters from the yeasts, and then a lot of the aromatics in the hops.
Yeah.
And I think there's such a range of flavour and texture in beer that I feel that it should be... It's kind of got this low rent, you know, image to it. Although that's changed hugely since the craft beer thing.
Yeah, it does change, but yeah, I think
People think fine wines, you know, and or even you know pretty good wines, and then the beers would be more kind of down market.
Yeah,
and also I don't know about in Greece, but in England, I think there is a very strong perception that you have red wine and cheese.
Mm, yeah,
I'm not sure where it comes from, but I do have two theories. But the main thing I think is if there are, I think there are now 2,000 distinct varieties of cheese in the world. So that's 2,000 sets of flavours and textures, a unique
yeah.
match, all of those. They cannot all go with one kind of wine, it's mad.
True.
And also I think the tannin in some of the bigger reds has a very strange effect on soft, creamy textures like some of the softer cheeses we've got. So I don't know where it comes from. I think one thing is, in the Middle Ages, just to stick with the whole history
yeah.
We drank an awful lot of claret from Bordeaux, so much. I think we might have managed to kind of drink more per head of volume of wine than we do now. I might be exaggerating. It was a lot. And I just think if you said to an English pie, no, right? It was, I don't know how good it was because they couldn't age it.
Yeah.
They couldn't age in the bottle.
Mm.
So it was, I think it was pretty young, pretty sharp, I imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
But, nice for cheese, actually, I think.
Being more delicate,
you know.
Yeah, yeah, maybe that's
younger.
Why. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe that's why. Mm. Also, I just think if you said to a medieval English person, you know, wine, they'd just think of claret.
Mm.
Then I think the other thing is if people start their meal with a white, they're going to move on to the heavier wines and the reds by the end of the evening. So that's when they have their cheese, is at the end.
Yes, yeah.
So is it that they've moved on to the red
yeah.
at that point? And I would just then open another bottle. I'd be fine. I'd just, like, open the white. That would be cool.
Great. So I want to ask you, obviously, from your research into cheese and all your experience, what are the prevalent theories of how did we first make cheese? And
yeah, so
why humanity?
it's a wonderful story for me. The discovery of cheese making is an image of human ingenuity, also of human inquisitiveness and hunger, but of ingenuity in a sense that I love it about humans. And it's our biggest downfall. You know, we invent cheese and we invent cars.
Yeah.
You know, and it's all part of the same sort of, I want to go fast. I want to eat that stuff and milk. You know. So in 7000 BC, all adult humans were lactose intolerant. They could not digest
milk.
Once you were weaned off the breast, you began to lose the ability to digest milk.
Mm.
When you make milk into cheese, you make it digestible for lactose intolerant people. So you heard it here first. Every lactose intolerant person can eat cheese.
Right.
If cheese is making you sick, it isn't the lactose intolerant. It's something else.
Right, okay.
So this is a bit of a scoop.
So there's something else there.
Yeah,
yeah.
It could be an allergy to certain proteins in the milk. It could be, modern milk from... factory production is from really intensively bred Friesian Holstein cows is
right.
Unnerves me. But so I think you had these herders and they're raising goats. There's all this milk. They're hungry people. Peasants are hungry. And they wanted to eat it. And every time they ate it or drank the milk, it made them really sick. Somebody happened to notice that, well, they had some milk. They were really hungry. They'll try again. This milk had been sitting around and had soured. And by souring, the lactose is converted to lactic acid.
Mm.
And then you can eat it if you're lactose intolerant. So what I love is that someone is brave and crazy enough. This is the milk. I don't know. It's sitting in a dish for some reason. Maybe they were going to feed it to babies. Because they wouldn't. The adults wouldn't have eaten it.
Yeah.
Why would you do that? It makes it. So it's sitting around. It's gone clumpy and sour, you know. And they drink it. They try it. And they're like, I didn't get sick. And I think they went back and convinced all their relatives and friends, look, I didn't get sick, look. And after a while, it'd be like, oh, fine, okay, well, oh. So then they would have to figure out what happened to the milk. And people from the past aren't just more stupid versions of us. They're just scientists. They were scientists too.
Yeah.
And they... So I have a rather grim theory about how the first cheese came about, which my editor wouldn't let me put in the book because it's a bit grim. So it involves dead goats.
Right.
And if you think that dead goats is going to put you off cheese, I won't tell you, but...
Nothing puts me off cheese.
I think so too. So I'll just say... Because my original cheese origin myth is that someone had a bowl of milk, it soured, they drank it, and they didn't get sick. But I'm sceptical about why are they keeping this bowl of milk? What's it doing sitting around? What will they do with it? If you open a baby goat's stomach once it's dead, obviously you'd wait till it died, otherwise that'd be horrible. You will find cheese in it. Because the way that ruminant animals get nourishment from milk is by making cheese in their stomach. The bacteria in the stomach and the acid sours and thickens the milk, and they have natural rennet in their stomach, which coagulates it. So inside that stomach, you find cheese. Now, peasants are hungry. They eat. They see this stuff. They're going to eat it. Maybe they made a sausage by rolling up the intestine or whatever. Yeah. And they didn't get sick. So it had the bacteria and the rennet all in there.
Mm.
This is similar to the story. There is an origin story that's quite famous widespread. There's even a little film of it, of the origin of cheese.
Yeah.
But I believe that it's, I'm afraid, nonsense. So in this story, there's a nomad and he's got a bag of milk under his saddle and it's made of the stomach of an animal. And he's riding along the desert on his camel or horse or whatever, you know, and gets off at the end of the day and he's going to drink his milk and it's turned into cheese and it's really nice. And so, wow, he discovered cheese. The nomad would have been lactose intolerant and there's no reason for him to carry
a milk.
So humans invented cheese before they were able to drink milk. I also think it's fantastic for a culture if you can harvest food in the summer and then preserve it and keep it till the winter. So all of the sausage and pickles and cheese is just a survival strategy.
Yeah,
and the tribes who did it outperformed the tribes who didn't. And you look at cheese making, it spreads beautifully as people moved out of the Fertile Crescent and one direction they moved was north, up into what was then, was to become Europe, they brought cheese making with them. So then the text starts appearing in archaeological digs as they head up through Europe. So this profoundly European cultural practice of cheesemaking comes from the Middle East, which is fantastic. And I love it. I love that. Also, it seems as if lactose tolerance... So humans developed the ability to drink milk in adulthood. It's called adult lactase persistence, if you really want to get into it, but... Lactose tolerance spread with cheese making. It spreads out, as you see the evidence of cheese making, in the bone record, you see humans developing the enzyme to process milk. So it's as if a gene piggybacks on a human culture, which is mad. I mean, it's probably far less romantic. I'm not a geneticist, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it's
pretty cool. It's
a brilliant story.
And so being able to digest milk is another excellent adaptive trait for human cultures because you get more nourishment. So then the cultures that could digest milk outperform the other cultures.
Yeah.
So in a sense, from 7000 BC, there's been cheese imperialism. This is the cheese imperialism of cheese-making cultures spread out and taken over.
Taken over, which is cool. Eat your cheese if you want to conquer the world.
To conquer the world,
yeah.
Yeah. I was just going to suggest that we try the next cheese.
Yeah.
So this is beautiful mould ripened goat's cheese.
Yeah. And I was told, we should eat this fresh. It's very fresh, yeah.
Excellent.
So, I'll leave it to you too.
So it's grown this beautiful rind on it. And in a sense, for me, this is what happened when cheese making came to Northern Europe.
Mm.
Even perhaps to Rome, and to the Roman area. Because in the Middle East, it's too hot to leave cheeses around long enough to grow this rind. They would sour, go crazy, they wouldn't taste good. So you either eat them fresh, or you preserve them in brine like your feta, which is an ancient, ancient form of cheese. And I'm absolutely convinced that even before Greece, the peoples of the Mediterranean basin were trading in feta.
Right.
It was a major trade. So once it gets into the north in a cooler climate, you can grow a rind on it, a mulled rind. So what I think happened is the peasant woman who was making her cheese, because it was all women, and they made these kind of small, soft cheeses, just like we're eating. She keeps them in her cellar or in a barn. And some of them stay there enough to develop a rind.
Mm.
She's a peasant. Peasants are hungry. So she eats the cheese, goes, gee, that's nice. In whatever language she spoke. And I think then mould ripened cheese is born. I'm sure it's an accident, like cheese making. And it's like it's the progression, in a sense, from when they move out of that area of the Fertile Crescent and into Europe. And I would argue that Britain, was a great place to make these sorts of cheeses, nice and moist and cool, you know.
Yeah. So when did cheese making spread to Britain? Is it simultaneously with the rest of Europe, more or less?
No, there's a lovely... So 4000 BC is where you locate the first evidence for dairying, and I think by extension cheese making in Britain.
Mm. All right.
And again, it's shards of pottery with traces of milk fat. It was something that archaeologists only discovered in, I think, 2013, how to tell what kind of fat it was. Before then, you just knew it was fat. Being able to distinguish dairy fat from animal fat means you can then say this is direct evidence for dairying. In 4000 BC, people are still lactose intolerant, so it has to be cheese, yogurt, fresh cheese. It has to be some processing. Yeah. So 4000 BC. There's enough, you can see these waves of farming culture coming up through Europe, and then they stop at the channel. And then after a while, they come over.
Okay.
So one theory that I love is a wonderful archaeologist called Francis Pryor. And he said, the land of Britain is so bountiful that the hunter-gatherers didn't need to develop the farming techniques that people over the, 20 miles over the water were doing, because they didn't need to. And hunter-gatherers have a lovely life. Farmers have to work much harder. Mm. They become shorter. They become less healthy. They die younger. Yeah, they're malnourished. Yeah. Sounds horrible farming.
Yeah.
So I just imagine these Britons lying
gum
around.
Disease, you're nuts. Everything.
You're killing a boar.
Yeah.
I reckon it was beer and maybe cheese. So they go over to see their French cousins, and they've got this beer and this nice fermenting.
Mm, yeah.
You know, you kind of got to settle to start making beer and, grow grain.
Exactly.
And it's just cheese is good. You know, more of a settle. So then maybe it was that. Maybe it's beer and cheese that made us start.
Yeah.
There's evidence, the first evidence seems to centre a lot around Stonehenge. So the builders of Stonehenge were fuelled by cheese, which is lovely. In Ireland, there's an amazing field system in Ireland called the Cadair field system. I probably pronounced it poorly. It's from, I think, 3,500 BC, and it's colossal. It was the largest field system in existence at the time, I believe.
Right.
And from some evidence of age of the bones, it was dairy farming. So that looks as if the Irish were doing large-scale, proto-industrial dairy farming 5,500 years ago, which is so cool.
Extraordinary.
So that's, I think, how, as far as I see, from what I've seen of the evidence, what I read in my interpretation, it's that. Mm. For a long time, we thought the Romans introduced cheese-making to Britain. And the Romans were really scathing about the British and said they don't even make cheese. The Irish eat their families, and they don't make cheese.
They don't want to.
But I think we did.
Yeah.
And I think that they brought new techniques, but that we were already doing something.
So in a sense, I suppose, the very first cheese we tried was the fresh cheese of Neolithic people in the Fertile Crescent. You have something pretty fresh again, but with
a mold rind. With a mold rind. Aged. Yeah.
Something that probably appeared in North Europe.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I think so. More. I mean, mountain cheese making as a whole culture, that for me, it predates countries. You know, the people of the Alps didn't, they weren't French or Swiss or Italian then.
Mm, yeah, I know.
But they made cheeses that were the product of the kind of cheese making you had to do. You're making you're making them high up in a mountain pasture because the pastures in the Alps go up and you have to follow the snow melt. You have to.
Exactly.
And normally you'd use a lot of cheese in cheese making, a lot of salt, sorry, but you don't want to carry bags of salt at the mountain. So they made cheese at higher temperature to not have to use so much salt to suck out moisture. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they got particular flavours and bacteria and textures to the cheese. And if you think of Fontina or Gruyere or Comté, they have similar textures and flavours because they're all that culture. You know, they had the same pressures on them.
Yeah.
And then I think it's Pliny, one of the Roman writers, talks about cheese in the markets of Rome from the Gaul Alps.
Yes.
Vatusican, I think it might be called. And it sounds like a Beaufort to me.
Right.
They're big wheels. Also, they would have to be big and hard because you're not going to take tiny goat's cheeses on a cart from an Alp to Rome. You know, no. It's not going to work and it's pointless and they would be ruined. So they'd be big, hard cheeses. So I think arguably some of the Alpine cheeses are really ancient.
And I remember I was trying to find about Roquefort, about Roquefort, and there was a story about Pliny or something that was mentioning some cheese of the Gauls.
Yeah.
But I think that might be a little bit of a myth of the people who make Roquefort trying to...
Yeah, I wouldn't want to, mess with them, but everyone has their origin stories.
Yeah.
Everyone takes the story of Charlemagne getting some cheese off the monk and digging out the mould and everything as it's Brie, it's Roquefort, it's, you know. The cheese he describes, I think he talks about it being served fresh or something. And Roquefort is months old. You wouldn't serve it fresh. You want it to bloom.
No, exactly. No, it wouldn't be the same thing at all.
No. So I wonder, I mean, my other problem is, you know, when you start asking, was this cheese made then or was it like this then? Or is we don't know what the cheeses were like, even if they had the same name.
Mm.
If I could go back, you know, if I could build a time machine, I'd go back and eat ancient cheeses. I'd so do that.
I think that's...
That'd be amazing.
That's the only reason to build a time machine, really.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So any other funny myths about cheese?
Well... Here's the thing, it's sort of a myth, it's in the world of myth, and it also allows us to try another cheese.
Yes.
So,
brilliant.
Did you know that Cyclops, or Polyphemus, was a cheesemaker?
Yeah,
I do know
that, but obviously...
Yeah, you're Greek, you know, most people don't know. And when you read the section in Homer, it's almost a recipe for cheesemaking, because he talks about coagulating the milk... with fig sap, I think, which is a traditional thing.
Very traditional, very brilliant.
And really ancient thing to do. He talks, Homer talks about pressing the curd in baskets, like kind of wicker cheese moulds, and about having the cheeses on racks, nice and spread apart so they dry, just like Pliny tells us, you know. It's so amazing. You read it. I'd never realised this before I came across this passage in a cheese book. And basically, it looks and sounds to me, it's sheep's milk, like a kind of pecorino sardo. This is based on Manchego, what we're about to eat, I'd say. But these hard sheep's milk cheeses, of which there must be many in Greece as well, are truly ancient. And so at first, when I started researching the book, I imagined a kind of 19th century style progression of sophistication, you know, from the first most primitive cheese, then it grows mould, then you learn how to make hard cheese through technology, and then you make the wash rind and so on, as if there's this progression in human endeavour from the simple to the complicated. And this has been around, when is the Iliad, is 3000 BC that it's written down?
No, it's about 3000 years ago from today.
From today?
Yeah.
When it was written?
Yeah, written, yeah.
But wasn't it also... handed on before then, orally. So the belief is that the stories are much older.
Much older.
Yeah. So people have been making this for thousands of years. I've got to say a thing about this. It's a lovely batch. What you want to do is crack it and then smell at the cracked face.
What is?
It's the smell of a tropical fruit. What is that tropical fruit?
Oh, wow, okay.
Do you get the fruitiness?
I get the fruitiness,
it's a bit
yes.
dried out because I bought it yesterday, I'm afraid. I'm going to eat some.
It's not pineapple.
Yeah. Well, that's what I get. I get pineapple. And when you... It's very common for people to register pineapple from this cheese. It's
right.
called Birkswell, by the way.
Yes.
It's made in the Midlands. It's made on a farm not far from Coventry.
Yeah. My friend lives near there.
Really?
Yeah.
So have you had this before?
Mm.
So I think that this is ancient. I also think that, well, I'm certain that the Romans brought a hard sheep's cheese to England, to Britain. So they had, the army, in its ration, had 1 ounce of cheese a day for each man. It was hard sheep's milk cheese.
Mm.
That's 5,000 men in a full-strength legion, so that's 5,000 ounces of cheese a day that you have to have, you have to make.
I mean...
You can only make it from the spring to summer, so you've got to make...
So it has to be something that's preserved.
It has to be preserved, it has to be hard, so that it can fit in there.
Yeah.
You know, you can cut it for the rations, and you need to make a lot. So you want to make standardised cheese, you know, in size and method. And you find in the archaeological record all over Britain, Roman cheese moulds of a standardised size and shape. I love this. There's one in the British British Museum that's perfectly preserved. But there are I've seen them in little town museums, literally all over the British Isles. Same size and shape. So, and they are often associated with Roman army sites.
Yeah.
So they made cheese. Also, they didn't ship 10,000 Roman army cheesemakers over from Liguria or wherever to make the cheese. I think they brought a few people over and they taught the local people how to do it in the big Roman industrial dairies.
Yeah.
So they brought a kind of proto-industrial cheesemaking to Britain, I believe. It may be a crack. Well, I think the evidence supports it. And I think that some of that method would be left when the Romans left or faded away or, you know, the cultures melded together.
Yeah.
I'm sure that some of the methods stayed with them. And that. So if you look at... There's this bit when the Romans go. We used to call it the Dark Ages.
Yeah.
And I called it the Dark Ages because there's no one wrote anything down for ages. And it's really hard to find anything about cheesemaking from about 500 CE till about... Well, 16th century when it really starts to get written down, but a bit annoying. There's little glimpses in the fog which are amazing. So there's a lovely Welsh king called Hywel the Good, and he was good because he had these very fair laws. And a lot of his fair laws were about women's rights and women's rights in the divorce. And they were entitled, and they, I think, could divorce their men. They didn't have to wait around. They could initiate it. And they got, apart from other stuff, all the cheese still in the brine bath. So this is in the dairy.
In the brine bath?
And it's in a brine bath. So one thing we know is they were brining their cheese in Wales. when's that? 2,000 years ago. So my mate Todd, who makes the cheese, the reason I'm a cheesemonger, brines his cheeses in a brine bath. You know, he's in Western Supermare now, but when he was in Wales. So that's 2,000 years of continuity. But he also says that... When his retinue arrive at someone's, you know, stately home, they're going to provide him with certain things, these tubs of honey, some ale, and it's a list, and it says, and 10 cheeses. That means this cheese must be a standard size, because he just says 10 cheeses.
Yeah.
So he knows how much he's getting. So that standardisation, I reckon, came from the Romans, and we're still doing it, you know. Mm. Yeah, and this was 900 CE or something.
Yeah, yeah. Brilliant. Fascinating.
Mm.
Do you want to try that feta cheese?
I really do so much.
Listen.
I'm just going to spear this whole big bit, if that's okay. Is it sheep and goat?
Sheep and goat, yeah.
Yeah, it's fantastic, isn't it? Speaking with my mouthfuls, I'm so excited. Mm. It's got that real animal taste.
Yeah.
I love it.
Good taste.
Yeah. But not too goaty. And I think this is partly the softening of the sheep in the flavour. It's just great. It's really tangy.
Very tangy. And I think it tastes like the feta cheese I used to eat as a child.
Yeah.
And I can't find it for the love of money nowadays.
Oh, it must be so sad. So does this bring you back, you know, when you eat it? Are you back there in Greece?
I am, yeah. My family's table.
Mm.
Having a slab of feta with everything, basically.
Mm.
Every Lance.
Do you think that the feta of different regions would taste different? Or, I mean, is it a slightly different method from, say, Cyprus feta to Greek mainland feta? Or
I think so.
Or
think
soil so. Or something?
So, because you can only make feta in certain places. So, it's obviously North Greece.
Yeah.
The prefectures of North Greece, Macedonia, Epirus, Thessalia, Stereo Ellada, Peloponnese down south, in Crete, in Lesbos, the island of Lesbos. And I think that's a place you can name your cheese feta.
Right.
In a certain way. Other places make as well exactly the same cheese, but they cannot call it feta.
Yeah.
But yeah, it does taste different. Because it's from different islands, different climates, and different soils, and so on. They have one in Peloponnese called Sfela, which is it's called Feta of the Fire. I love the name.
Yeah,
it's more intense. Basically, it's a lot more intense. Similar to feta, it has a different method of making, but yeah, it looks similar. And again. You eat it on the table or you can fry it and so on. But yeah, it does have an intensity that you don't have with feta.
How interesting.
And then you have one in a small island in the northeast of the Aegean Sea, near Turkey. So the island, they do it in little wicker baskets, exactly the same feta style, but in wicker baskets.
This sounds like the Iliad, the Homer story.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And I had one in October, so my father came and he brought me some, and it was so delicious. It was harder than feta, but it had that tanginess and saltiness, and it just transported me back to 2,000 years ago or something. I thought that's how cheese was made.
Absolutely,
and that was brilliant. And then there is the places that they do cheese with all sorts of different ways. Like there's one that they spray a bit of seawater.
Really? What, on the cheese as it's maturing?
As maturing,
Things does like it that. Turn out like a washed rind, like these pinky ones that we've got, or does it just stay more like white?
I think it has a rind. Really? It has a little rind, It's very interesting. Cheese making, I think you find the common things with every culture.
Yeah.
And you see, how we're all
relate the same. Yeah. I love when I visited some French cheesemakers a few years ago. My French is about 30 years old. And also they're speaking, I'm going up an Alp and speaking to this guy Dede. He's this tiny little shack. It's probably medieval, and his French must be some crazy dialect. But I know what he's talking about because I know that he's got his hands in a vat now, so he's just saying like Charlie's going, well, I've got my hands in the vat and I'm going to break the curd up to this size now, and then okay, now we're going to ladle the So it's kind of a way to improve another language, except that I would only know how to talk about making artisan French goat's cheese. I wouldn't have any other vocabulary.
I think there's
that's not a problem, is it?
It's enough on the subject, yeah.
So I want to try the oil. I started cutting more cheese, but I want to try this oil.
So this one is from Peloponnese, and this is an Italian guy making olive oil in Greece.
Oh, great.
And it's organic, and he won a gold award for this olive oil. And I think this year is exceptional.
Yeah.
This year, it's the best he ever made it. So yeah, just pour a little bit on the spoon and, swirl it in your mouth like you do with wine. And
oh, yeah. Oh, it tastes of greenery.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's just fantastic, isn't it? And quite peppery.
Peppery. Peppery.
It's actually hot, like a spice. Ooh, can I have some more?
Yeah.
I want to pour it over the cheese. Is that allowed?
That's more than allowed.
Good. It's lovely to have. So the cheese is from the Peloponnese and so is the oil.
Yeah.
This is like drinking wine and cheese in the same area, isn't
it?
The,
yeah.
What grows together goes together.
Some more oregano.
You have to give me more oil then because I just ate mine. I couldn't stop.
And some more oregano from
thank you.
North of Greece.
Is it?
Yeah.
God, do you get your family to send you over like aid packages or something?
Sometimes. Smell it. I don't think...
Oh, wow. It's a different smell. It's more woody than our cheap English rosemary. Sorry, I want a bit more on with my rosemary and oil.
I think you liked it, didn't you?
I really, really like it. I love it. I had a wonderful oil on Korčula, an island in Croatia. And I went so mad about it that I think the guy who produced it thought I was a bit crazy. He'd never seen anyone go so mad about this. Do you know what? I just make it my farm. You know?
Yeah,
it's not
yeah,
even just... a kind of fancy producer. I just make this stuff. You know, and oh my God, it's so incredible. Yeah.
I get that with olive oil. I get that. You can't beat this freshness when you have fresh olive oil.
Yeah.
Just, it has a different taste, completely different taste.
This is a bit crazy. Do you get a tiny, tiny hint of banana?
Okay.
Just tiny.
I'll have a bit on its own so I can see if I can taste the banana.
I mean, I've got it. I think we sold a Kalamata oil where I really noticed the banana. But,
right, okay.
Which to me, almost, if I notice a flavour a lot, I almost feel that it has failed. In a cheese, I kind of want to be going, is it rose? You know, and not really, I don't want to be going, oh my God, it's bubblegum. Yeah. Like, not necessarily. I mean, sometimes it's funny. The pineapple thing, when you open a whole Burt's Well and it goes, boof, it's funny.
Yeah, I think that's a different proposition.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very fresh, you open it, yeah, okay, you can smell it. But in this, it's subtle. It's very subtle.
That's just fantastic. Well,
and I think I only went for pineapple because you said tropical fruit.
Yeah, I try and lead the witness a little bit.
I think I'm going to try that.
So, but also, sometimes it's more pronounced and everyone says it. People often ask me, how do you become a cheesemonger? How do you train? You know, and I said, you eat lots of cheese. And they laugh. And then you're like, I know, it's a good job. But but you really do. And so every morning, you take all the cheese out of the cellar and out of the fridge. And you put it out on the counter. And you taste all of it. Because it's ripening. You can't say to someone, here's this lovely mild brie, when suddenly it's just shifted a gear and it's become really strong.
Yeah.
So you're tasting all the cheese. And you're talking to your fellow cheesemonger about what you're tasting. So you're matching. This is what I believe is happening. There's a network of your brain that does tasting and a network that does labelling.
Right.
And then they're forging connections. So if you do this a lot, you get good at going, oh, I think I can taste butterscotch, some hay, you know.
Yeah.
It's not that I'm special or clever. It's not that I have amazing taste buds. I really don't. I've just done it a lot. And I think with sommeliers, if you're talking to other people, I'm doing the wine swishing mime, you know.
Yeah.
That's how it. You get good at it, I think. So I love that because it means really anyone, I mean, unless, God forbid, you had lost your sense of smell, anyone can do this.
Yeah.
And just, what you need to do is eat lots of cheese with your mates and talk about it. This is the best job.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. So basically, we left the Neolithic kind of era, went to the Roman era, and we're
kind of a little bit post-Roman now with sort of the Dark Ages out of that. It's a bit boring, not enough cheese writing. Yeah, we were swiftly through that. There was one thing, another thing I picked up that was lovely in and this is more, my expertise now is much more in Britain than it would have been before when I was looking at early cheese making, is that there's a record of the rents that the women cheesemongers of London have to pay to the local authority from maybe the, I think it's the 10th century.
10th century, okay.
Yeah. They have to pay more at Christmas. So what it means to me is you sell more cheese at Christmas back then, just like you do now.
Yes.
You know, when I had my stall at Borough Market, the whole stall lived on Christmas. And for the rest of the year, it was a howling desert of poverty. And then you just made all the money at Christmas. So stressful.
Oh,
so do they. Mm. And so that also suggests to me that some of the cheeses this lady was selling on her stall were fancy, were more quality. You bought your treats for Christmas, the cheese.
Yeah.
Because I've always wondered, what kind of food is cheese? Is it a staple food for the peasant, like your thing that we have to try soon? Or is it a fancy food for the lord? Or is it a ration for a soldier? Or is it, a kind of fancy gourmet thing? And it's hard to tell, but I think also both and all.
I think so. Yeah, I think it's a bit of everything.
Yeah, and possibly when you look at, I mean, if there's recipes with cheese in an Apicius, then the Romans must have also considered cheese to be a treat and a fancy food as much as a staple. But they called it white meats in Britain, and they meant the crummy stuff that the peasants eat, you know. As we move more into where there was more stuff written down and I kind of couldn't know a bit more, what I see is that the milk got the rich people got cream. The rich people got the fat. So if rich people got cheese, it was a full fat cheese. If you make cheese from, well, you can skim the cream off and you can have it as cream, or you can turn it into butter. Butter was always a high value product that you sold to rich people. And then you can make cheese with the remaining milk, but usually it's going to be hard and less flavoursome.
Mm-hmm.
And so you give it to the poor or the soldiers. You know, the workers, and the posh people get the nice stuff.
I know maybe it's a bit silly comparison, but what kind of cheese would be that nowadays? That the poor.
Well, that's such an interesting question, because that kind of cheese wouldn't exist anymore because food has got so cheap now that no one needs to buy the crummy skim milk cheese.
Yeah, yeah.
So if I were to say Parmesan, the people of Parmesan would kill me. and it's one of the great cheeses of the world.
Yeah.
But it is made with skimmed milk.
No way.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not full cream milk, as far as I know. I mean, God, I wouldn't want to malign it. But I think
it's
a great
skimmed. Cheese. It's amazing cheese. It doesn't
cheese.
Matter. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
And I think also it shows some skill to maybe skim some cream off and make this absolutely amazing cheese.
Yeah.
So, but I think we have some descriptions, and there's a lovely name. So in the Middle Ages, Suffolk rose to power. Well, East Anglia rose to power as the absolute governor of cheesemaking in Britain and just wiped everyone else out. They were a pinnacle. And this came as a considerable surprise to me, because when I was a younger monger in the early noughties or whenever, I didn't think you could make cheese in Suffolk. I'd never heard of Suffolk cheese.
Right.
Which I apologise to the cheesemakers of Suffolk now. I hadn't really heard of it. And I kind of assumed the land wasn't right and didn't know of any tradition of doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but the thing was that it was great dairying land. They had their own breed of cow, a Suffolk Dun, that was a brown cow, maybe like the red cows of Italy that make great parmesan, maybe like the Swiss brown, so maybe a lot of good cream in the milk. And they got a contract to supply the English army in the fight against the French in the Hundred Years' War.
Okay.
So, well, they got a contract to supply the garrison in Calais, and this was big money, and they did really well. They went over to cow's milk because nearly all the cheese in Britain was sheep until around that time, which is something a lot of British people don't realise, that sheep's milk cheese is a traditional British cheese, and people are surprised.
So, yeah, that we're talking about the Hundred Year War.
The Hundred Years War, 13-something or rather to 1453, 14th century, 14th, 15th century.
14th century. So, up to then we had sheep's milk.
Yeah, and one reason for that, I believe, I think it was popular anyway. Sheep dairying was done, cows weren't really there for dairying, they were smaller.
Is that sheep's milk?
This is sheep's milk too, yeah. So this is Lord of the Hundreds, which is a suitably medieval name for a cheese. The hundreds are, you know, kind of like within a parish you have hundreds, if I've got this right. Which are like small administrative areas.
Ah, I see. Okay. I was very intrigued by the name.
It alludes to that kind of feudal farming of the medieval time. I think. I assume that's what they mean. You can see it's sheep because it's pale.
Yeah.
God, I better have sheep. I'd be dead. No, it is sheep, isn't it?
No, it is.
Softer than the Burt's Well. Less floral. More sheepy. It's excellent. I love the texture. Sheep's milk is quite high in fat. And so you get really creamy cheese. Harder to make. I think it's very easy to make rock-hard sheep's milk cheese.
So nice.
Yeah. So, so the Suffolk guys are making this cow's milk cheese, selling cheese to the army. They're close to London. And there's lots of great water transport to London. And London's where you needed to sell to if you wanted to make any money ever, you know, in Britain until the Industrial Revolution and the other towns started to spring up. You know?
Yeah.
So they did very well. But they had a problem in the cheesemongers of London, or the London cheesemongers, who were a sort of unofficial guild consortium of extremely powerful businessmen, had their own fleets of ships, their own networks of stores around the country. And they forced the Suffolk, the East Anglian cheesemongers, to skim the milk more and more and more, to get more and more butter, so the London cheesemongers could make more and more money. And they would say, for every pound of cheese, it's whatever, half a pound of butter. And they kept increasing. They said, now it's a pound for every pound of cheese. And they kept increasing the proportion. To the point where the Suffolk cheese was skimmed so much that it was rock hard and tasteless. And it had a terrible reputation. It was called Suffolk Bang. And there's a poem about it which went, "Those that made me were uncivil. I am harder than the devil. It says, fire won't sweat me, a knife won't cut me." And people hated it. They gave it to the Navy. So the Navy in that period, you know, tough men who ate salted beef that could be 100 years old in these casks. And the Navy refused to eat it. They wouldn't eat it. So this great power of cheese making in Britain rose to this point and then was broken partly by that. Also, there was some flooding in Suffolk and there was cattle plague. Mm. But altogether, it just kind of destroyed the Suffolk cheesemakers. So the story of cheesemaking in Britain is the story of kind of rise to power and tragedy, like an ancient tragedy. Yeah, you know, they were brought low. And they tried to stop it. The Suffolk cheesemakers went to Parliament to say, look, these London cheesemakers are forcing us to do this thing. It's putting our cheese into ill repute. This was by the 17th century, so it went on for a while.
Right, okay.
The cheesemongers were too powerful. Just broke them. That I should say, and I always like to say this in public, it's very important, that my friend Jared has a shop called London Cheesemongers. It's in Kensington. It's an excellent cheese shop, and he's a very nice man, and he would never single-handedly destroy the cheesemaking culture of an entire region of Britain, I promise you. It's not Jared. He's not the same as them. But we should go back, actually, and talk about the monks a bit.
Yes.
Because it allows us to try a couple of other cheeses.
I was going to ask about the monks because...
Hugely important.
Surely we have records as well from...
Some, yeah. Some really interesting records. I mean, one thing about research for me, I was going to the British Library. I was trying to drill down as far as I could to some sort of bedrock of primary source. but I cannot read medieval British monastic Latin. And I would get these books, and there's always a 19th century book, and it's always by Colonel something. After he retired from the army, he's found an interest in, you know, medieval monastic accountings books or something. And so the introduction's in English, and he says, yes, and you know, and there was the Dairying and Sibton Manor and so on. And you think, brill, and you open the chapter to Sibton Manor, and I started making this sound, this emotion would come over me, like, muh, because it's in Latin. So I was restricted.
It must be very
It was frustrating, yeah. But there are, I found one beautiful thing, and it's he's one of my favourite guys in the book, actually. And he was a I think, PhD student who wrote a study about monastic industry and agriculture. He's called R.A.L. Smith, and he was really into cheese. He was really interested in cheese. So there's loads of stuff about cheese, because they're huge businesses, wool, and grain was the big business that everyone got into. It was the aristocratic thing. So people tended not to be interested, historians or the writers, in cheese. But this guy just loved it. So I was in the rare books and manuscripts room of the British Library. It's quite a quiet place. And I opened this book and I yelled with joy. And, you know, and the thing I'm excited about is I found monastic cheese-making treatise. The other thing I love is that he wrote it in the middle of World War II. I think it was 42. This was quite old. And it's such a random find, you know. So this is an obscure thing. It's a funny little sort of tract. But this guy, while World War II is raging around him, and I think it's 42 or so, so it's not looking good. You know, you could easily think we're going to be invaded by the Nazis, you know. And he decides to write a treatise on medieval monastic cheesemaking. I just loved him. What a great human. So he, and the thing is, what you can tell from his study is that it was almost a sort of industrial system. It was big, large scale. They really started nailing standardisation. So they talk about three sizes of cheese. They talk about how much milk you can get out of a cow, and how much of that's going to turn into cheese. They knew this from these treaties on estate management that were written around the time. Part of this is to make sure your cheesemakers aren't ripping you off. So they would to see if you might be skimming off cream.
Yeah.
I'm pointing at you saying you're this criminal cheesemaker now. You might be skimming off cream, or you might be stealing cheeses or something. Because you needed this for your family. And they knew. So there's a bit in the records where they're talking about two manors, and they're both owned by one monastic house in Canterbury. So these are like two farms, and they've each got a guy running them. And one of them's making way more cheese than the other one. And I always feel really sorry for this other guy, because you know that he gets brought in by the abbot, you know. So, John, how come Joe down there is making more cheese? You stealing cheese? Because you should be making this much. So they knew. But the other thing that isn't written, because they don't really describe what kind of cheese, they don't describe what kind of cheese it is. You kind of guess from the tech.
Right.
And the sizes and things.
It's not because you can't find the text.
They don't say things like, the abbot presented me with a lovely Canterbury cheese today. It was hard and it tasted of flowers. And, you know, and they're not like us talking about these flavours. I don't know if they even thought like that. I don't know. But you guess a bit from sizes and shapes. I think they're fairly hard cheeses because they're quite big.
Yeah.
But I also think that they were making washed rind cheeses, which are, we tend to think of as French, Belgian, perhaps German. They are the soft, pink, sticky, very pungent cheeses that divide the world, you know, into, oh my God, that's amazing. And that's not a foodstuff. Why have you done that to me? You know, which was my wife's position for a long time. Now she's coming round. But the thing about these cheeses, if they were made over on the continent, all these monastic houses were in communication with each other. And there's a constant flow of people. They're bringing texts to another monastery to be copied. They're, you know, visiting to check that everyone's adhering to the monastic rule.
Yeah.
And I, you know, some guy goes over to France, he eats this cheese, he goes, this is amazing. And the brother John, show me how you do this. And brother shows him, and he brings it back to his monastery in Gervaux in Wensdale, and says, look, I've got this recipe, mate, this is banging, you know. He didn't say banging, because they wouldn't have said that back then. But so these cheeses are pungent, creamy, salty. They're quite luxuriant. I don't think the rank and file monks ate the stuff this good.
No,
I think they ate the skimmed milk, hard, you know, peasant cheese. I think the abbot might have eaten cheese like this. Yeah. Love it.
Remind me, which one is this? What?
My mouth's full of cheese, Tom.
That's why I'm asking now.
And I'm going to have a glass of wine with it. This is this lovely Gewürz. Gewürz and gentle washed Rhine cheeses. Lovely, lovely match. The cheese is so savoury and salty and slightly barnyardy, and the wine so sweet.
Yeah.
Like salted caramel with a kind of funky, rude edge. It's called Durrus. This cheese is from Ireland. It's from County Cork. County Cork is the centre of... It's where one of the places where the great cheese renaissance kind of kicked off in the late 70s, when people started making artisanal style cheeses again. Mm-hmm. So the thing about these washed rind cheeses, what you do is you wash the young cheese in brine and salt water.
Yeah.
So you take your thing that looks like a pirouche with no rind and you wash it in salt water. It kills the mold spores that would grow on it and turn this into a form of brie or camembert. And it encourages a bacterial rind to grow on the cheese because this bacteria loves wet and salty conditions. It's a bacteria that's around it, it's on our skin. So I think the first wash rinds happened by accident. I think there's a monastic cheesemaker, or perhaps affiner, a person who's looking after the cheese. He maybe doesn't know he's doing that.
Sweaty hands.
They didn't wash much back then. Bless them. He's maybe not making the cheese, he's storing it for his boss. He's not a full affineur yet, he just keeps it and tries to not let it go bad.
Yeah.
Some of the cheeses go pink. He's a monk, he's hungry, he's got a boring diet. He tries it. It smells a bit funny, but he tries it anyway. And it's amazing. And he thinks, how do you do that? So they figured out, you know, experimented and figured out its brine. And
it could have taken
100 years or something.
Yeah.
But humans are smart, and, you know... But salt water. Cork is right on the west of the Atlantic coast. Veronica Steele was trying to make hard cheeses, and all her cheeses turned into washed rinds because the salty wet air. And she said this lovely thing, and eventually she gave in and started making a cheese called Malines, which is super funky, much more intense than that. And she said, you have to make the cheese the land wants you to make, which is one of the most beautiful things anyone's ever said about a cheese.
Yeah.
This is just glorious.
That's definitely...
Every cheesemaker would understand that, you know, in whatever culture or language. So this Durrus, it really comes from the land, from the, you know, from the wet, salty place. And this earthy flavour, maybe. And I think this is a monastic style. And I think that we probably did make these cheeses. Not in the monasteries themselves, because... You don't have cows and that inside the monasteries. You have them on a farm.
Yeah.
The monks weren't really supposed to... They weren't supposed to leave the monastery at all.
Yeah.
So the idea of the farmers... Farmers made... And they had cheesemakers making cheese, I'm sure of this. The monks didn't have their arms in vats making cheese because they weren't doing that. But then the cheese was brought in. I think what the monks did do, though, is become affineurs.
Oh, yeah.
Because they were looking after the food.
So
I think we can thank the monks for affinage, in a way, maybe... Peasant women are too busy to mess around washing cheeses.
Yeah, yeah.
And they lost so much. And, you know, there's another thing we can thank Henry VIII for, is maybe there were more monastic texts on cheesemaking. Maybe there was some monk who wrote a letter to his brother monk saying, listen, I just had this amazing cheese and it tasted like flowers and, you know. Maybe it's there.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know how so many of those ancient manuscripts got used to bind books and things. Maybe one day... We'll open an old book and find a monastic treatise. That would be nice. I'd be really pleased if that happened.
Should we try the other washed rind, which is the Isle of Avalon, which... you know more than me about it.
I'm not sure. So is it by the same people who make Lord of the Hundreds?
I can't remember. I think
it might be. I mean, for one thing, it's got kind of romantic British naming.
Yeah.
You know what the Isle of Avalon was?
Is that something to do with King Arthur?
Very good. Yeah. It's where he, you know, when he fell into his long sleep, he's taken off in a boat to the Isle of Avalon. And he'll come back when everything goes wrong. So he should be back quite soon, right?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Similar story with there's a Greek king, emperor of Constantinople, that he was made a statue when the Ottomans invaded.
Yeah.
And they took the city.
Yeah.
And he will come
and
back.
And he'll wake up. I didn't know that. Yeah. Isn't it fascinating? And we can speak about this because it speaks to shared cheese culture.
Yeah.
That you can have the same story that you've got your king. Yeah, he's in a statue, but we all have our kings under the mountains and buried in the statues. And you know, we all have the blue cheese myth. I love this. You know the blue cheese origin story?
Yeah, a little bit, but
so there's a peasant.
I think we have to
tell us. And he's looking after his sheep, and he has this lunch of some bread and some fresh cheese, like the feta or like the pirouche. And then the story diverges. So for most cultures, the story is that he sees some bandits appear. So he runs away and he hides his cheese and bread under the rock. Unless you're Italian, in which case it's that he goes away to see his girlfriend. Which I love. So the Italians are perfect. They just fit their stereotypes
so beautifully.
I know. I love that. So anyway, he goes off to see his girlfriend and runs away from the bandits or whatever it is that he does. And he comes back a while later and remembers where his food is because he's a peasant and he's hungry.
Yeah.
And then the mould from the bread has got onto the cheese and the cheese has gone blue, but he's a starving peasant, so he eats it anyway.
Yeah.
And, as I keep saying, thinks, that's amazing, how do I make that? Now, the reason I think it's not true, not perfectly true, not literally true, is because every cheese-making culture I know has the story. And
yeah.
If you feel like if everyone's got it, it can't be like totally true. But given it's the same mould, you know, that's on bread.
Yeah.
And given that cheesemakers used to make bread, let it go mouldy and use that mould to make the blue, I think they may still do in Roquefort.
Oh, maybe.
It's possible. Yeah. There must be a bit of truth in it. And again, you have the image of the hungry peasant seeing the cheese is blue. They're going to eat it anyway.
Yeah.
And then they develop it. But I love the way, yeah, and the Italian sort of cultural stereotype is just gorgeous. I haven't heard that story in Britain about Stilton, though, which is funny. Maybe we need more powerful cheese origin myths. So it's great because we've got, you know, I've got plenty of job left, which is going around telling people how amazing British and Irish cheese is.
Yeah.
And also that we have this tradition for thousands of years. And that we, in the 17th century, there was a boom in Cheshire making. It became the cheese. It took over after the Suffolk cheesemakers were wiped out.
Yeah.
London cheesemongers looking for a new cheese, found the Cheshire, started selling in incredible amounts and exporting hundreds or thousands of tons to France. Such big business. It all went out of the port of Chester. And in France, they have a cheese called Chester, which French people sometimes think is a British cheese. It's never existed. We've never called it Chester. And it's a vestige of that historical thing that they used to get their cheese from Chester. The other thing that happened then was the trade was going down from Chester to London and then back up with goods. You know, they would sell the cheese, buy goods, bring it up. Changed the economy of the Northwest, and because it just brought all this money, it brought all these goods in. But it also created a new class of criminal that I just love, which is French cheese pirates. When we went to war with
the French,
the reason they were French cheese pirates, I'm sure there's been British, actually I know there's been a British cheese pirate, but that was back in the medieval period, and he was pirating French ships and stealing their cheese.
We need to hear about the story, but tell me
French cheese pirates, because we went to war with the French, which is basically the national pastime for the British, was going to war with the French until about 1914 or something, when we found someone else to go to war with. But So it was 1670s, I think, and so they were like privateers. You know, this is the other funny thing: because they're French, they're privates. The British ones are called privateers because they get some letters from the king saying, "Yeah, you can go and nick French stuff."
Yeah,
and then they go out and nick it, but they're privateers.
So they were probably pirates.
Yeah, pirates. They were probably English cheese pirateers too. Yeah, but I love that. I found out so much wonderful stuff while I was doing the research, and mostly that we do make wonderful cheese. We always did. There's a lovely bit of writing that another cheesemonger found for me, and it's an Italian writer, medieval writer, and he wrote a treatise on milk and dairy products. A lovely man, and he talks about the wonderful cheeses of England that you buy in these markets in what's now Belgium. He says they're delicious, really highly prized, they're huge, they're beautiful, they have kind of stamps of flowers and decorations on them. He says, if anything a little bit hard, bit indigestible. He says maybe if they used less sheep's milk in the mix, they would make it softer, which is true, I think.
Right,
because if you need different amounts of rennet to make cow and sheep cheese. Mm. So if you mix the milks together, you could maybe end up with a cheese that got very hard, I think. And it's really prized. And I just want to go around with that and show everyone, you know, look.
Yeah, look.
You know, the foreigners don't hate us. They loved our cheese. They thought our cheese was great. Yeah, cheese is magic.
Shall we give it a go to...
Yes, please. What is this thing? Now, it didn't come out exactly how I meant it to. This looks lovely, Tom. What is it?
For a few of my catering events for ancient food, I make a sort of fancy version of a peasant's lunch, in a sense. So you had onions, cheese, olives, some nuts, which was the peasant's lunch or the farmer's lunch. And these ingredients in a kind of fancy cheese log, modern sort of thing. So it has feta cheese and a bit of pecorino romano mixed with fresh spring onions, olives, grilled artichokes or marinated artichokes, all chopped finely. And then the crust is smoked almonds, which I usually smoke them myself.
Wow,
in my smoker, really? But not during the week, the winter. I just bought them from the shop.
Brilliant. I've never heard of anything like that.
So let's have some fancy peasant's lunch. There you go.
Thanks, Tom. So this is... We do have the best job in the world, don't we, really? But sometimes I wake up and laugh. I used to wake up and think, oh, God. You know, when I was at work as an office boy or something.
Yeah.
Now I just wake up and chuckle when I think about what I'm going to be doing.
Oh, yeah, it's magical.
Mmm. Mmm. It's really delicious. It's like... It's kind of like a really posh boursin with bits.
Mmm.
I know that doesn't... Yeah, that, I'm not. I'm going to work on my compliments, Tom. I love the really open texture.
Totally normal. Totally fine.
There was actually... I tried dead goat cheese in the cheese festival in Bra, in Italy, near Turin.
Okay.
And they actually had... They get a goat, a dead goat, they open it up and they put milk in and then they bury it for a while. And that's how you make the cheese. And I still think that's the best thing I've ever seen. I've got to have some of that. I mean, only a cheesemonger would think that's the best thing I've ever seen. So I enjoyed it and I was fully ready for it to be really difficult, you know, sort of animal. And it was just like feta. I was a bit disappointed. I think if you're brave enough.
And that's,
it's just feta. I mean, good feta, but pretty funky. But not, you know, like you think if I'm brave enough to eat dead goat's cheese, surely it should have a bit more, you know. But, I hadn't then... That was years before I thought of writing this book.
Yeah.
So maybe the vestige of that image was in my head when I was thinking about how would you possibly discover cheese making.
True, yeah.
I think they make this in Greece still. I think they maybe just take the stomach, though. It's not the whole goat.
Yes.
And then they would fill that with milk. And But I think they do bury it. Maybe. You would know.
So I've been investigating some Greek cheeses from all over the different areas. And there's so many islands, so everybody does a bit things differently. But so far I've seen it in islands.
Mm.
Goat's stomach,
mm.
filled with milk, mature, blah, blah. But so far it's all hung and they're dried. I haven't seen something buried.
Mm.
But maybe that's happening. I have to find actually some people that they know a bit more about these things. Cause
it's also possible, yeah.
The cheesemonger.
I mean, I might have, no.
I'm not suggest.
My Italian is almost non-existent, so it's entirely possible. What they meant was we make the cheese, wrap it in goat stomachs, and then bury it or something. You know, so it's made, matured, and then buried to store.
Right.
I think people buried stuff to store it.
Oh, yeah.
Often in amphorae or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I often cry about cheese. I cried in Bra when we went to see the Cravero maturing house. So as far as I know, all the maturing houses for Parmesan are owned by banks. except right, for okay. one, which is the house of Cravero, the family. There may be more families. This is the one I met.
Mm.
But it's rare anyway. And his family have been doing this for generations, for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
So the first son is always called Giorgio. And when you go to his office, which is in the stone, almost a castle, there's all the paintings on the walls of the Giorgios going back hundreds of years. It's like a vampire, but with cheese. He's a lovely man. And then you go to the maturing room, which is a cathedral of cheese. I mean, it's the size of a cathedral, and it's the shape, and it's got tens of thousands of wheels, I don't know, going up into you can barely see.
Can we mere mortals go and visit it?
Well, I don't... Exactly. Maybe. He's very nice. I mean, you could ask nicely. You must be able to. It's not the only house that matures. They would be crazy to not allow tourist visitors to see it. When I saw this and looked up and saw 10,000 wheels of palms, I was just crying, you know. And Georgia's going, what? Nah, just cheese. But he knows. It was amazing. And also you're thinking, again, they've been doing this for 1,000 years, you know. The guy's moving the parmesans. It's 35 kilos. When I lift up a parmesan, it's quite a business. You know, I prepare for it.
Yeah.
You know? And it feels like you're just at the edge of your capacity. And these guys are just flipping them and moving them around. It's not strength, though. It's the amazing
technique
of moving stuff that, again, you imagine, like, their father did it, his father.
Yeah, yeah.
So I love the pastry. And is it from an actual recipe or is it inspired by?
Inspired by.
It's just delicious.
Yeah.
So I really love cheesemongers because they're really obsessive. Lots of recovering philosophers become cheesemongers. I'm too a recovering philosopher. That was my first degree was in philosophy. I think largely because you can't make any money out of doing philosophy, so you do other stuff.
Exactly.
But so in my book, I imagined a kind of Romano British guy, and he's quite posh. He's got a villa, and he's in with the Romans, you know, and he's got some fancy foreign Roman cheese on his dinner table, you know, some Vatusican from Rome or something. And he's got some nice local fresh cheese. And it's rolled in Kentish cob nuts.
Mm.
And then my lovely friend Doug, hi Doug, he wrote to me and he said, it's a good book, Ned. And I was like, yeah. You know, if cheesemongers say it's good, it's the best thing. He said, but listen, Ned, cob nuts didn't come to Britain until the medieval period. You know, you'll have to change that. But I loved it. You know, that's what I want. You know, if I messed up
very
in that
specific,
way, that's okay.
Yeah, yeah, very specific thing to tell you.
To know and to, yeah, that's, and it's in the quality of, you find it in good cheesemongers because this is not a job you do if you want to get rich. Mm. It's not a job you do if you don't want to get up at 4 a.m. every day in the week up to Christmas. It's not a job you want to do if you don't want to turn 100 cheeses in a cellar. You know, but you need a real commitment. And you need a sort of integrity. And it's the same with being a cheesemaker. I have a theory that you can't make great cheese unless you're a decent human being.
Mm-hmm.
Because you need patience, you need to be gentle, you need to be calm. Not all cheesemakers are calm, but they're pretty calm. You need to have total integrity.
Yeah.
I loved the Lord of the Albert, what was it called again?
Isle of Avalon.
We didn't comment on it.
Yeah,
much more funky than the Dallas, much more intense. I love that.
Very funky.
So this is, I say this about every cheese I like. This is one of my favourite cheeses. I just say it's about every cheese.
It's like cheese.
It's so hard, yeah.
You can't.
This is French. And we're going kind of back in time again. It's called Cantal. Specifically, Cantal au lait de Salers. So it's made from the milk of the Salers cow, who are a breed local to the Auvergne, native to the Auvergne. And the milk has a character, has a flavour. Well, this is said. It's also, it's made, traditionally it's made in wooden vats, I think called gerre, if my pronunciation is right, it's probably terrible. The wooden vats, which are often quite old, just contain the bacteria in the wood, like a starter culture.
Yeah.
So they don't need to use starter culture, they just put the milk. Ancient. There was a time, I say recently, that the French government or hygiene, you know, department wanted them to stop using these things and use steel because they were worried about the hygiene implication. And so they did a lovely experiment with, I think, souring milk in a gerre, an old gerre, and souring it in a steel vat, and then introducing a pathogen to the milk, and it went rampant in the steel vat and died in the wooden one. because there's a huge population of bacteria all competing. I think, and
there must be.
There's an argument that raw milk has enzymes that can protect it to some degree against some bacteria. I think I've read a paper on that. I'd like to read more. But just that this natural way might just, you know, there's a reason that they were doing this.
They've
been allowed to keep this.
Brilliant. That's a good, good story.
It really is. Mm. They make it. Traditionally, you made it in the Bjorn, the stone hut, up in the mountains of the Auvergne. You go up in the spring, and you're up there on your own, or with your with a few mates, you know, looking after the cows, making cheese. You come down in the late autumn.
Yeah.
And that's your life. It's tough. This is lovely. This is... It's got a slight bit of heat, the Cointel.
Yeah.
A little bit of pepperiness. Interesting. Thinking about the pepperiness of the oil.
Very different from all the others.
So different from the others, yeah. It's I would say it's quite a friendly, mild batch for this cheese, because you can get some Cointel, or the super authentic one is just called Salers.
Right.
And I've given that to a room full of people and heard the sound of 20 people going, because it's so intense. And sometimes they leave it easy. They're not really eating very much of it. My friend has had cheeses where she said, you know, they range from the glorious to absolutely appalling. Yes. Thank you. Oh, this is so exciting. This is the Roman pesto type sauce. Right. Yeah. This has just appeared on my plate. Got to eat this thing first. Yeah, it's so important.
Yeah, yeah.
So tell me again what's in this.
Pecorino. Garlic, lots of garlic.
Some garlic.
Yeah.
Ooh.
That's lots of garlic, fresh coriander, and a few celery leaves.
It's so different from pesto that I almost thought it was mint, but it's the celery and coriander.
Yeah,
it's got that more that. It's not phenolic. I can't. There's a word in my head. It's more like the dill end of the spectrum of herbs and the less savoury.
Yeah, yeah. It's and it had almost a bitterness and soapy, soapiness. Aromas, you know.
It's really glorious.
So it's, I left it for the end because it's so strong with all the garlic. You don't want to.
You're never going to taste anything again.
Yeah. So that's the last thing you can eat.
That is the correct amount of garlic, by the way.
I love garlic and I love that, but that you're going to be tasting that for the next week.
It is essentially a pesto, isn't it? Isn't it lovely to think that there's this ancient forebear of pesto?
Yeah. 2,000 years and 2000 nothing, years. Almost nothing changed.
It's so magic.
Bit of white wine vinegar, a bit of olive oil, cheese, lots of garlic, and herbs. Before you go, I would like to ask you if there is any sort of home cheese that people can make themselves at home.
You could. So I am not a cheesemaker. I'm a cheesemonger. I've made a fair bit of cheese, but I'm no expert at making cheese. But you absolutely can make cheese at home without any special equipment. And I could say that here is a really simple cheese recipe now. It's a bit of a cheat. But get some milk, heat it to a kind of blood temperature, I think, and add some yogurt, and then let it sit somewhere warm for a while, and then then drain it. And there would be a kind of soft, fresh cheese. Maybe don't eat it. It would be okay. Because when you make yogurt, you have to heat the milk to almost boiling, or even boil it slightly.
Right, okay.
And it denatures the protein and changes the texture. And you can then drain that yogurt, and it's kind of a form of soft cheese. But it's kind of a different thing from, you know, you're not taking milk to that temperature when you make cheese. But you could do this with a sieve, a bit of cloth, a couple of pots, some milk. If you want to get fancier, you can buy cheese starter cultures online.
Okay.
And you could just be a prehistoric cheesemaker and just buy some culture, get some milk, and start fooling around. And, you know, you might kill yourself, though, because probably in the history of cheesemaking, it's a very safe food. People don't tend to die from cheese. They die from chicken. Bad.
Yeah.
But it's a way of making milk safer. But, you know, if you just fooled around by yourself, you might make something a bit moody. So the other thing I would do is I would get one of two books. There's a book by a guy called Paul Thomas. Oh, I think it's called Home Cheese Making. It's the book about cheese making by Paul Thomas. Paul is a fantastic cheese maker and teacher. And he comes from the microbiological end of this, and he is a measurer. and a
you're
going to
be safe.
Yeah. And you're going to, you know, he's got a brain the size of a planet. His yogurt recipe, like my mum's yogurt recipe is get yogurt, get milk, heat it till it's the right temperature by sticking your finger in, put some yogurt in, stir it,
that's
leave
it
in the warming cupboard. Yeah, and then eat it. And his is pH times, you know, makes amazing yogurt.
Mm.
If you don't want to go down that rigorous route, Morgan McGlynn, who owns a cheese shop in Muswell Hill Cheeses,
yes.
She's written a lovely book of home cheese making and some cheese cooking as well. And that would be that's a more... Paul's not inaccessible, it's just demanding.
Yeah.
And Morgan's is a more, for the sort of more dilettante... Gosh, I sound like I'm slagging Morgan off. It's a lovely book for just having a go, you know, and making some interesting stuff. Those would do you fine. I would use a book. You can buy cheese making kits.
Right, so there are ways to do that.
There are ways to do it if you want to do it.
Yeah. I mean, the easiest thing I've done is buying a really nice yogurt and letting it strain on a cloth, a bit of salt.
Yeah.
And let it strain for a day or two and just make like, it's yogurty, but...
Yeah, it's kind of a fresh cheese. I mean, and, you know, I'm not sure if there's a real, absolutely nailed down official legal description of cheese, because as far as I can see, there's this vegan business that I don't really hold with, but they call it vegan cheese, so
yes,
they must be able to.
Yeah, yeah.
I think if you made some yogurt and strained it, it's fresh cheese.
Yeah.
I also think that it's a great idea to make some yogurt because you're on the same path.
Mm.
And you're starting to do this kind of thing, fool around with it a bit, and get a feel
culture,
for it.
Yeah,
and the culture.
Yeah,
yeah. Mm. I would do that.
Lovely. On that note, thank you very much for
coming. Thanks, Tom. That was great.
And tasting all
this
amazing.
Thanks for the lovely food.
See, just great.
Cool.
Thanks for listening. I have been Thomas Dinas, and this is the Delicious Legacy podcast, and I had with me Ned Palmer, and I hope you enjoyed what you heard. And if you want to subscribe and help me create more interesting content about ancient food and gastronomy, please go to my Patreon page and kindly donate as much or as little as you can. Thank you. Have a lovely day.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.